Welcome once again to Food Conversations, a program about food and all its aspects from planting seeds to eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shuswap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shuswap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. And I'm here in the studio with our show's producer, Steve Corey, who will be doing some announcements as we go along today, as he has done on every show so far. Today, once again, our guests are Herman and Louise Bruins, co-owners of Wild Flight Farm and organic in the Mara region for nearly 30 years. Hello, Herman and Louise.
Hello.
Hi, Warren.
Hi.
I am going to tell the world that I've caught you once again in one of your greenhouses working diligently to prepare next year's harvest in its nascent form. And because
this year's harvest,
yes, next season, I should say, which is coming up. Yes, if it was next year's harvest, this would be quite a tragedy. I must say that it does prove one thing, and that is that a farmer's work is never done.
And I'm moving celery plants from a tray into I'm moving them up into their bigger containers.
The celery plants need the help that they can get from humans. And I notice you're using a chopstick. By the way, listeners, once again, we're doing this on Zoom. Herman and Louise are on the farm. We're here in the studio, Steve and I. And this works really well. And it's not only a COVID precaution, but it's a really nice arrangement because you can stay on the farm and we can interview you in person. It's a wonderful thing in flagrante delicto, as it were. Okay, tell me why you're using a chopstick, Louise.
Because it's just a handy tool for teasing apart little plants and moving them into their new home. And they're biodegradable, and I'm reusing because when I go out, when I get takeout food, then I bring the chopsticks home with me and they have a second use in the greenhouse.
This proves another famous precept of the farming world. Repurpose everything as necessary. Nothing needs to be wasted. Well, Herman, Louise, you've talked already with us about the trajectory that led you to establishing what is now a flourishing organic farm in Mara. We talked about the trajectory, about you getting together in the unlikely place of a coal mining town in northern BC, and then about various aspects of your work, what was like starting off a farm from scratch, essentially, while raising two children. Today, I think we could really profitably talk a little bit more about a different side of your lives and your work, and that is your experience and knowledge of how the farming world works, your own operation, and of course, the situation in this part of the world as well. Where it may be going and how we might get there. It's going to be a no holds barred discussion of what really is happening in the farming world, because obviously farmers cannot live on theories. You have to live on pragmatic outcomes and possibilities. So that's going to be, I think, an important thing for us to talk about. Now, I mentioned already that you're on your farm and we're in the studio, which I think is a sign of some of the things that are changing in our world, and that is that we don't have to travel to every exotic corner of this planet. We can communicate in some wonderful ways, and I have in this studio, I have a screen that I'm able to see the two of you, which is really spectacular when you think that you're able to get your repurposed chopstick and make celery plants happy, and I can sit here in this studio and send a program out to the audience who could be theoretically anywhere on planet Earth. So let's talk a little bit. Now, you're in a greenhouse. So let's talk about your greenhouse evolution, the evolutionary process of greenhouses on Wild Flight Farm. You started out with a 10 by 10 repurposed plastic from the house you were building at the time, Herman. But you have a lot more in the greenhouse line now. Why don't you tell us a little bit? Herman, you probably had to do the building while Louise put them to work. What What was that like, building up a lot of greenhouses?
Well, we have to credit actually a fellow organic farmer in Armstrong for putting us on to what are we call them greenhouses just because that's what people understand. But in the farming circles, we call them high tunnels. And because they're unheated, they're basically just a tunnel. And the plants just benefit a little bit from the extra protection that they get from a sheet of plastic over a frame.
Sure.
Back in the day, probably cold frames, way back when, before there were structures like this, a lot of farmers were using cold frames to get things going. And in your gardens, that's what you do too often. Anyway, sure. This is just a bigger version of that, unheated, just a structure. Anyway, this farmer, he had just put up a new one, and he had an old one that he'd made himself, one of his first ones. And I was over there one day, and he said, "You know, you really should put up a one of these tunnels." And I was a little bit skeptical, but he said, "You know, I've got one here. I can give it to you. You can just take it and go and put it up." And so we did that, and then after we put that up, it was not a really large one. It was maybe like 12 by 100 or something like that. And we realized that, wow, that makes a huge difference. You can get 3 or 4 weeks. You can get lettuce and spinach and all kinds of different crops 3 or 4 weeks earlier just by growing them in the ground under this kind of protection. And so that put us on a path of realizing, okay, this is a really good thing. We need more of this because you can never have too much produce early in the season when it's still cold, and April and May, there's just not a lot around. So, we started putting one and buying new ones then, and putting one up, 20 by hundreds. Most of them are 20 feet by 100. So about 2,000 square feet each year. So each year at the end of the year, we'd say, okay, we have a little bit of money. We can buy afford to reinvest that back into the farm and put up another one.
So our greenhouse money. Our greenhouse money.
We didn't do one every year because we don't have 30 of them.
No, we ran out of space at a certain point, and we had to stop at about 13. So that's where we're at right now.
So have you ever thought, or is if you saved up a couple of years of greenhouse money, have you ever thought of building an enclosed greenhouse, one where you can have a sort of a climate control aspect to it as well?
Yeah, well, we do have one of the houses is the one that we're in right now, which is where we raise our transplants. That one does have a furnace in it and is heated because we do need to have those plants happy. They want to be at 20 degrees in March and not wait until later. So, we definitely have thought about it as well, but it just the economics are such that it just makes more sense to not heat it and use, you know, have to invest all those fossil fuels. I know there are some farmers that do it,
yes.
But we believe that we're better off, focusing on our storage vegetables through the winter and not heating greenhouses and insisting on eating greens that are really not, don't grow that well here. We're better off eating cabbage in the winter. So that's our strategy. And so it doesn't cost much to, you know, these houses, they cost about, $5,000 or $6,000 each, and then you have to and the cost of putting them up. So you're probably at $10,000 by the time you're done. That is a really quick return on investment because you're not putting more money into it after that. You're just getting vegetables early.
Well, sure. And we did discover over the years two winter greens that grow survive through the cold winters here, even with only just the layer of plastic for protection, and that's our corn salad and Phytonia.
Sure.
So we're able to, even without heat, we're able to keep those alive and often even able to harvest them even in the dead of winter.
So I'm proud to announce that I have one of your cabbages in my fridge as we speak. So I have bought into the wild flight approach to farming.
But are you going to eat the cabbage that's in your fridge?
I am going to eat the cabbage that is in my fridge. I will not eat my fridge, but I will eat my cabbage. I promise you that. So right now, your current marketing, you know, field to eater process involves the use of farmers markets primarily. That's where the stuff you grow on your farm goes, pretty much. But you also have a distributor. And that's an evolution that's been part of the process of establishing a wildflight farm. That involves a sort of an expansion of what you do on the farm itself. Could you talk about how you got into that use of a distributor, a local distributor, by the way, for people who are keen on local farming, which I think many people are. So how did that happen? Tell us about Lisa.
Yeah, so you're referring to Urban Harvest, which is a company in Kelowna. I don't know if I'd necessarily call them a distributor, although she does distribute our vegetables, but she's more like a retailer in that she buys vegetables from various farms throughout the throughout BC and beyond, and then puts together a box of vegetables for her customers that she delivers. So it's an organic home delivery business.
But she has roots in the shoe swap. Lisa, originally from Sorrento.
Yeah, she started off, actually, yeah. So when she was just out of university, she spent a season or two working at a farm called Sidoa Farm in Notch Hill. Mm-hmm. And so established a relationship with that farmer. And then she and her partner decided to move to Kelowna and start a business selling organic vegetables, because she saw that there was a need to try to get these great vegetables to people, you know, in the cities. There wasn't a good vehicle, because grocery stores are really, really hard to access for small farmers. Most grocery stores aren't able to really deal with small farmers. And so that wasn't a vehicle, and farmers markets are fine, but this was just an alternative way of getting local produce to local people.
So she started somewhat the way you started, with a food box delivery system.
Yeah, exactly. Except hers was much more flexible right from the beginning. Like, lots of farm-based vegetable box delivery schemes are kind of based on what the farm can produce and when it has it.
Right.
And most farmers end up, you know, just, you've only got a certain number of things at a certain time. So you pack the same box for everyone.
Sure.
Whereas in her case, she can access produce from multiple farms and beyond, in even importing produce. And so she can put together a much more varied box, or at least offer options. And so in her customers can, she puts out a suggested box of what she's going to put in, and then people can go in and change the items in their box.
So swap things in and out according to
their preferences.
Yeah,
they can either add things, or they can take things out, or swap things out, and so they can customize their box.
So did Lisa?
And that was sort of a big change for people. That was just a different way of doing it.
So did Lisa start off with that approach? In other words, using produce from other farms in the area? Was that a principle that was present in the beginning?
Yeah, she really wanted to support local farms as much as possible, but she also knew that she needed to be able to put together a varied box of that included fruit and vegetables and things. You know, if there wasn't much around locally, she would source it from much further afield. So, yeah, that was her original start.
She also had the educational component, similar to what we did with our early boxes, where there was always a newsletter with featuring what the local produce was in season and how to prepare it with a recipe suggestion. So she would encourage her customers to focus, you know, to eat more of the local stuff.
You were telling me, Louise, that initially you would have people who really needed to learn what you were doing from the ground up, but now you find a lot of your customers are very familiar with organic farming, organic growing, local produce, etc. You're not having to do so much explaining to people as you did at the beginning.
Yeah, that's true.
And I suppose that probably applies to Lisa as well, I hope. So tell me about these clandestine meetings you had at the base of Spring Bend Road. Herman, This was kind of a handover, clandestine handover that you had to Urban Market.
Yeah, it actually felt like that sometimes. We were sort of thinking, gee, you know.
They probably thought it was a big truckload of cocaine, but it was just vegetables. I mean,
yeah, exactly. We were on the side of the road on a little bit of a parking area, and we'd meet farmers from around the area, would meet and consolidate all their boxes of vegetables into one vehicle that would then drive to Kelowna to deliver this to Urban Harvest.
Now, was it your vehicle that did the delivery?
Initially, it was another farmer's vehicle. It was the one from Notch Hill, Sudoa Farm. Sue Moore was the farmer, and she was doing the delivery run. And then gradually it shifted, and we had the larger vehicle, and she was sort of phasing out of her farming career, and so we took over the role of delivering it the weekly produce
and your
haul to.
And your vehicle is refrigerated too, I understand.
Yeah, we have a refrigerated vehicle.
What kind of difference did having a refrigerated vehicle make in terms of the whole operation, both your farm and this process of reaching through to a retailer like this?
Well, it just makes it so that we can get the produce down there in better condition. Mm-hmm. And this makes it more a little simpler. I mean, before when we were doing it without a refrigerated vehicle, with Sue's truck, we'd often have a whole bunch of Coke bottles, like plastic bottles, filled with like filled with water and frozen. And we would be layering those with the produce boxes. So that was sort of an informal way of doing it. Okay. And then we'd throw a big sleeping bag over the whole works and then quickly drive to Kelowna.
Frozen.
So that was sort of, this is just a lot easier. You just turn the refrigeration on and it keeps this stuff cold.
This is going from the frozen Coke bottle / sleeping bag method to the refrigerated truck method. For all of you listening to this show, this is a process of evolution which we can all be proud of. Thank you very much, Herman and Louise. So you obviously, Lisa is a special kind of person. First of all, she came to a farm, she worked on a farm, and then she had a vision. And how important is that vision? It's obviously helped this process move along really to the point where it's now a very flourishing operation.
Yeah. Yeah, she just had this really clear idea that she wanted to make local produce available to people in Kelowna, to her customers. And so she just went out of her way to do the extra work, to talk to all the different farmers and find out what they had and organize the shipping and get it all to her warehouse on time so that she could pack it and send it out to her customers.
So we're talking about relationships being, you know, relationships, communication, connection, bringing people together. This seems to me the essence of the process that you're talking about and that has developed to what it is today.
Yeah, and I think businesses like Urban Harvest and they started, and, you know, we all started at a time like more than 20 years ago when the demand and the culture and the interest in local food and organic food was not really all that strong, and it's something that you had to educate and build. It wasn't just there to take advantage of, and so I think that Urban Harvest had to work really hard to build the demand and the interest in what they were doing through the education and then you have, you know, they had to have really strong convictions about what they were doing, because it wasn't easy a lot of the time. And, you know, there were struggles along the way. And if you don't have the vision and the conviction that it's important, then it's easy to just throw your hands up and say, oh, what the heck, like, people just aren't going to support this.
It says something about the strength, not of the vision, but also the insight into what's actually going on in the world, that both you and Lisa, with her operation, actually have ended up not 30 years later in penury, sitting at a corner in a homeless shelter. I am pleased to say you have a lovely place. But actually, expanding and growing, as it were, into a space that was already there but hadn't been filled. In other words, you've come not into a dead end, but you've actually opened up a path, or you've stepped into a path that is getting wider rather than narrower. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
Well, and in two ways, too. In one way, I mean, she's back when she started her business, the whole concept of an organic home delivery was pretty new. And there were various companies trying to start it in various cities. And she just took that model. So it was a new model it was a kind of a hybrid between grocery stores and farmers markets. So it just offered a new way to access, and particularly in this case, fresh and local organic vegetables. And the other thing I would really point out too is that her choices made a huge impact on small farms throughout the North Okanagan, and presumably even in the South Okanagan, because it offered yet another way to sell produce that was profitable, that could work. Yes. From a financial perspective. Like I mentioned earlier, that really the only option we had was a farmer's market. Yes. Because grocery stores were really hard to access and still are for small farms. And so this, she was just the right size and was focusing on small organic farms and created this extra market that really stabilized the income and improved the income for quite a number of small organic farms here. I mean, it made a big difference to us. And I know for several other farms too, it was a deciding factor that kind of made the whole farm a lot more profitable.
What I sense as you're describing this, and I sensed it when we were talking 2 weeks ago, is that what really distinguishes what you're doing and what Lisa and others are doing is that you're working in direct relationship with one another. You don't have this supply chain that is so global and so expanded that you don't have a clue who you're really dealing with, because they're either in another country or another part of this country or in a social world that is far removed from the actual practicality of growing food. And I mentioned this when we were speaking before the show, a little bit about what distinguishes what you do from what, say, a large producer distributor entity does, such as Save On Food, just using them as an example. You get to know one another, and you get to be able to make adjustments to work with the people that you know. There's a sort of a network and a flexibility within the network that is more, in some way, I would see it as a bit more resilient, although it took a lot of hard work to get where you are now. But once it's established, you have those relationships and those connections available to you all the time. Why don't you talk about that a little bit, and what's experience been like for you?
I think that's a really important aspect of what we do and everybody in the local food community does, and communication amongst ourselves, and also the cooperative relationship that we have amongst ourselves, and then also the connection that we have with that we all have with our customers. Mm-hmm. Whether it's the other farmers in this area or urban harvest and delivery programs like that, when they're locally based, and then having something like a weekly newsletter or other means of communication, or even just being at the farmers market and talking to your customers, you have these direct links, and so you've always kind of got your ear on the ground, and you're hearing what people like and what they don't like, and or what they'd like to see, and then that information is getting passed around amongst ourselves, and you get the direct feedback, which is really helpful. And we're able to communicate directly to our customers, often through our newsletter, saying, hey, like, this is what's coming up, and this is a really cool vegetable that you should try, and here's a recipe to go with it. And so I think that's a huge difference.
And well, I would say add to that and say that for people that are buying vegetables from and or their food, that we don't have to limit it just to vegetables, at a farmer's market or through some sort of a system where they know their grower, it just adds value when we have lots of customers that whose kids know, oh yeah, we're getting our carrots from Wildlife Farm. So when they bite into the carrot, they can be thinking about that, right? And I believe, it's similar to if you look at the wine industry, they've done a really great job of that, where, you pick up a bottle of wine and you think about the winery as you're having it and the varietal, and you know a lot about it, right? And sure. I think that's really there's some value there to that it just improves the enjoyment of eating. It's not something nutritional necessarily, but it's just a social value. And even for customers of Urban Harvest, they know exactly where all those items are coming. So if they see a bunch of radishes in their box, their list will tell them that it came from Wildlife Farm. And they might not actually visit the farm, but they'll know the farm name and they'll know a little bit about it through the newsletter that Lisa puts in her box as well, just highlighting who the farmers are and what they're doing. And so there's establishing that connection, and that's really hard to do. The grocery stores do try to do it a little bit with some of their local, when they do have a local offering, but it's it's much more difficult to make that connection between the farmer and the eater.
Another thing that's really cool is when customers will come to the market and they'll ask for specific things, because once they learn about something that's unique or seasonal or that you can't generally find in other places, then they really latch onto it and demand it. And they like to share information about how they prepare it. And I'll often hear people talking amongst themselves in the lineup at the market saying, oh, have you tried this? Like, I had that last night and I roasted it and, poured some balsamic vinegar on it at the end, and it's just so delicious. And then the person behind them will, instantly want to buy one too. And people kind of pump each other up and share their excitement for particular vegetables.
What you're describing clearly is a much richer situation than simply a vending machine approach to food. You're describing a whole nexus of interactions that carry with them a certain amount of warmth, a certain amount of affection, a certain amount of trust. It must have enhanced your work as you moved through this to have this feeling that you were relating in that way to your customers, who to some extent become friends.
For sure, yeah.
At the farmer's market, for example, I find that, it's a long day. It's usually a 12-hour day. In Revelstoke, we usually getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get there and get all set up, and we don't come back until 4 or 5. And so it's a long day from a physical perspective, but it's also, I always come back energized just because of my interactions with the customers and engaging in the, or experiencing the enthusiasm that they have for the vegetables and the appreciation. And it just helps, motivate us to say, okay, let's get out there and, put in those long hours and get the job done and make sure that our customers in Revelstoke get the best possible selection of vegetables.
I have a feeling that there's a lot of people listening to this show thinking, that's a really nice narrative to hear. That's the way we all want to live our lives. We want to live in an amiable world in which we have positive relationships with other people. We need to talk a little bit about what's going on in the broader scene with respect to food, because although you've had a lot of joy along the way, you've also had to face some problems, and some of those problems still exist today. And when we were, for one thing, the production of vegetables in this part of the world has declined radically. You're part of a new wave of bringing vegetable production and organic local food back into play. But that hasn't always been that way. And right now, it's not that way. The amount of acreage farmed with vegetables and a more diverse range of produce has shrunk quite a bit. Would you maybe talk about that a little bit, what that's like to be in is sort of what appears to be a remnant of production.
Over to you, Herman.
Over to you, Herman.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly we've seen when we started, there were certainly more larger scale vegetable farms in the area. They were farming conventionally at the time, and we're struggling because of competition from other areas outside of BC, where the same product could be grown cheaper. So that was part of the problem, and those farms eventually just either changed hands or stopped growing those kinds of crops because they just weren't earning money doing it. Mm-hmm. That was a little bit unfortunate. I think we're seeing that in fruit production as well throughout the Okanagan. It's just really hard to compete against Washington State. But with the advent of more local production and local marketing, like farmers markets and like these home box delivery companies, there's one in Vernon as well called Farmbound Organics, and same sort of idea. It offered a few other ways of getting produce directly to people, and also produce grown in a different way. So people were willing to go the extra mile to get organic produce, and that wasn't so readily available in grocery stores at the time. And so that's what kind of helped create this alternative.
So would it be fair to say that as you've been developing Wildflight Farm, there has been around you a certain evolution in terms of attitude, in terms of opportunity with respect to a growing market for what you've just described, locally grown, healthy, organic food, that there is a sort of consciousness shift going on to some degree?
Well, certainly over the course of our farming, there has been a consciousness shift, because we were essentially back, 25 years ago, we were the new kids on the block, the idealistic new kids that thought, oh, we should grow vegetables organically. And most of the rest of the agriculture industry kind of completely didn't really understand what that was, and didn't believe that it was really viable or could go anywhere, because they'd spent their careers and their lifetimes trying to come up with efficient, like it was all about price. And right. It didn't matter what practices you used, and the whole agricultural science community, and often even still is, still promoting that kind of a production model, just produce in large volume and using whatever tools, chemical tools you can to produce at a lower price.
Indeed.
But that, as we found out, has environmental consequences and consequences to the quality of the food and the taste of the food. And so, yeah, we were these starry-eyed idealists coming into it and thinking that we could make this work. And we had no idea whether this was going to work, but we thought it would. And so gradually that's what happened. There were customers as well. There were people that recognized that they wanted to have something different. And so the two worked hand in hand, the farmers and the eaters, to try to create an entirely different food system. And I think that's a process that's ongoing. And sometimes I'm frustrated that it doesn't go faster, but it is definitely there. And people are more accepting of it now than they were before, and understanding. Yeah.
I think it's probably better to be on the crest of the wave than heading down into the trough. And everything you've said suggests, and I think there are many others saying similar things as well, which I think is also a very important point. There are people talking about regenerative agriculture. They're talking about community relations. They're talking about all sorts of new ways of looking things, which are really a return to the ways we've been doing things prior to, we could call it, the chemical revolution in the late 1940s when chemicals became a central part of growing food, but now are under increasing challenge because it doesn't seem to be a good idea in the long run. Short-term gain, long-term pain. Now, One thing that you have done, as you said, the starry-eyed optimists heading into the void and then fortunately turning out to be part of a new wave of growing food that is increasingly acceptable. But one thing that you didn't have when you started out was you didn't have a template, a model to use. You had to fly by the seat of your pants, as it turns out, which, because they're strong farmers' pants, worked very well for you. But nevertheless, it must have been a bit intimidating, and it still is a void in the food-growing world. Training programs in this part of the world in particular are very skimpy. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, we have a lot of informal opportunities for people to learn if they are perhaps working or doing internships on other farms or woofing, or, you know, there's various ways that young people can gain experience, but there isn't really any kind of a formalized education system where people can learn standardized best practices, kind of efficient ways of doing things. It's very scattered, and we just find it really challenging ourselves to find people to work on our farm who come with some skills and experience that they can kind of jump in and hit the ground running. We always have to train, sort of start from scratch almost, training people on what we do here.
So it's ironic, is it not, that for things like carpentry, electrician work, even hairdressing, there are so-called, I think the term you usually use is red seal courses. That's courses that have some kind of formal sanction from governments, or at least from some kind of regulatory body. There are courses for all of those things, but there aren't for growing food, which we need to eat every day. Does it not seem for you, even though you started out as just starry-eyed optimist, nevertheless, you're starting out in a core part of the human experience, which is that we need to eat food.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a little bit frustrating for us as well, is that we do talk a lot about wanting to have a local food system, but we're missing some of the key pieces still, and we just haven't got to the point to realizing that we need to have a really good education system so that we can pass on the knowledge that our generation has gained in developing this kind of a food system, to that we can pass on those hard gained knowledges on to the next generation and get them to pick up from where we left off and go further, rather than having to start back where we were 25 years ago, you know, with very few resources. I mean, there are definitely some more resources, online resources now, but we were using it at the time, a book written by another farmer that was doing this in the States called Elliot Coleman. And indeed, a lot of farmers were referring to his book. It was kind of a seminal book at the time. And it really tried to show how to grow vegetables on a scale for farmers markets, in the diversity that you need for farmers markets, and how to do it organically. And so that was what we were using. But yeah, things have come a long way.
Now there's the modern day version of that would be the Jean-Martin Fortier from Quebec.
Indeed, from Quebec, yes.
Yeah.
He's
a book and also offers an online course.
Yeah,
which is,
but we need something much more formal that has sort of a government sanction to it, so that you, when you come out, you have a certificate saying that you've completed a 4-year apprenticeship, and that will entail knowing all about, you know, a whole range of different aspects of farming. That's ideally, I think, where we have to go.
Indeed. I happened to be at a conference some years ago where Elliot Coleman's daughter was a presenter, and she talked about the fact that her father, the land he was given or inherited or purchased, was very poor. It was actually land that was being considered almost you know, hopeless for farming. And now it has some of the richest soil, the best tilth, as they call it, of any soil in the world. And it was because he like you, by trial and error, moved his way up through from this very depreciated form of land to create some of the best land in the U.S. Now, Jean-Martin Fortier from Quebec is considered a bit of, I think the term was rock star in the food growing, organic, small scale organic farming world. But his course is expensive. It's something like $3,000 U.S. And some of the practices that he uses aren't necessarily transferable to a situation that you guys are working in. There's some things that just aren't practical. Maybe you could talk about that, Louise, a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, every farm is unique in the way they do things. And I mean, I'm not even really sure whether there is a standardized or a best way of doing everything, but there certainly are best practices for doing a lot of things. I do find with this course that, you know, a lot of the what he's saying is spot on and super useful and really good advice. But in my experience, you know, looking at some of the techniques that he uses, I won't go into detail specifically, but some of his techniques do seem extremely time consuming and would I would consider to be not practical in our situation. His scale is a little bit smaller than our scale, and the equipment he uses is different than what we use.
Right.
And so that's one of the challenges that you kind of deal with, I guess, with an education program is what kind of a standard do you use? And they do seem to have it much more standardized in Europe. you know, we had mentioned that our friend Heino, who came to work for us and now has his own farm, he and his wife Manuela have their own farm in Grinrod, Roots and Greens, but he comes from a very you know, formalized or a more formalized education apprenticeship program in Germany, where I think the practices are pretty much uniform throughout the whole region and everybody learns the same thing because they've developed over hundreds of years what is the best way to bunch carrots and the fastest way of doing it.
You described Heino as the only person, you said earlier that you were often having to teach your workers how to do what they were doing, but Heino was the first person who came along and actually was able to teach you things that were new. And that must have been a revelation for you to see how much he knew and how much of it was useful for you guys.
Yeah, it was. It was very eye-opening.
Yeah.
And I think that's maybe when we first started to realize that that's what we were lacking here in Canada is a formal education trade that farming vegetable production should be considered a trade.
Indeed.
As an education system behind it.
When we're talking about the lack of education and how it changed your perspective on what growing food is all about, after talking about Elliot Coleman starting from scratch and building up a farm out of nothing, and about your starry-eyed idealism, which turned out to be correct, as it's always a pleasure for that to happen, when you saw that Heino, coming from Germany, knew all about farming because he had been trained in a sanctioned, accepted, standardized course, some lights went on in your heads. Some little light bulb switches were turned on. What was that like?
Well, it just, I think it just showed that we had a long ways to go in Canada. We were nowhere near where they are in Europe. And I mean, I kind of knew that because I've been to Europe and seen the selection of organic produce and that they have there. And it's just miles ahead of what we have. But yeah, this was just another example of it. And yeah, there were just techniques that they were developing and using in Germany that were not even heard of here in North America.
And also specific tools that
talk about insect mesh. Talk about insect mesh. insect mesh.
Yeah, so the insect mesh was an example of that where, when he was here and we were covering our radishes, for example, with Remate, and then having to put up with the fact that the radishes didn't really grow very well under Remate. And the reason we had to cover the radishes is because there's a maggot that's called the cabbage root maggot. And the way to prevent the damage from the cabbage root maggot organically, I mean, if you're doing it conventionally, you just spray it with an insecticide. But what we were trying to do is keep the fly, which lays the egg at the base of the plant. If we could keep that fly away from the base of the plant, then they couldn't lay an egg, which couldn't hatch into a maggot and go into your radish and make a mess of it. So we were using this material called Rene, which really is more designed for frost protection and just getting things to grow a little bit quicker early in the spring or late in the fall. But it doesn't work very well for radishes because radishes, especially in the summer, don't want to be too warm. Mm-hmm. And they need the light. The Rene was also taking light away. So Heino said, well, how come you're not using mesh? We use that in Germany. And I thought, well, what is that? And it's just basically big sheets of fly screen is what it is. It's white fly screen. And it just keeps, you put that on your crop instead, and it keeps the fly away, and it doesn't trap heat, and it doesn't take a light away either. So the plants were much happier under there and grew much better. And it made a huge difference on what we could grow and how we could grow it.
And how much did it make a difference in terms of the plant, you know, the amount of food you got from the plants you put in the ground? How much percentage-wise, roughly, say, did it increase?
Well, on some crops, we would lose easily 50% due to damage. We'd have to be sorting through the carrots and sorting through the radishes to just pick out the best ones that weren't affected. And so it was a big shift, and we actually had to go to Germany and import the stuff ourselves, this mesh, these big rolls of mesh. And then some other farmers heard about it and they started importing it with us. So we do a big order once a year, and it made a big difference. And it was basically just this one technology that they had been using there and we hadn't. So
there's a distributor in Quebec, I understand now.
Yeah. Now we can get it in Canada. So, yeah.
Louise, you talked in terms of learning, you talked about such what would seem like such elementary things as how you position yourself when you're harvesting and how you how you put radishes in a bunch. That obviously somebody like Heino would have had something to say about that already. Or did you learn from him about things like that, or was that more of a practical learning process for you?
We definitely learned a lot of techniques from him as well, because you can kind of make up your own way of doing things. And if you're only doing 10 of something or 25 of something, then it doesn't really matter whether you sit in this direction or that direction, or whether you hold the elastic this way or that way.
Right.
But if you're doing 150 bunches, then it makes a huge difference. That one, just a tiny little aspect of body position or a flick of the wrist, has a huge, you know, the time saving or the amount of stress on your body.
Yes.
You know, it really accumulates a lot. And so those kinds of techniques, unless you've been taught them or you have to develop them yourself by trial and error, but they're super important.
I hope listeners are understanding because we don't have these courses, these Red Seal courses for farmers, and because somebody like Heino can come and teach you a whole range of things and show you products and procedures that in this part of the world aren't even known, let alone utilized, it's quite clear that there is a lot of not just technology, but subtle and critically important nuances in the way farming and growing and harvesting and planting, etc., takes place that maybe is not appreciated by people who are purchasing food. They just see a bunch of carrots And maybe they see a bunch of carrots that came from a company that has a mechanical buncher or something of that nature, something that puts elastic band on in an assembly line. Whereas when you're growing local food and you're protecting its quality in every stage of production, these small, apparently small issues are actually really important.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's the kind of thing that you either have to learn from someone who's done it before a course that would be really great for people that are starting out as well. I think
for sure.
Part of the problem too is that, most people don't do their own electrical wiring or their own plumbing or even their own carpentry, but a lot of people have a garden or have had a garden as a kid. So it's a skill that people kind of look at as being not something that really has to be taught or learned. It's something that people just know how to do and doesn't really matter that much whether you do it this way or that way.
Indeed.
And so I think a lot of people kind of get into it thinking that they can just kind of fudge their way along and you can, but in order to do it really well, and to do it on a larger scale and to make a success of it as a business, it is really important too.
The two of you gave me a list of the components that you felt would be necessary in a training program. I'm just going to read them off because I think listeners will be surprised to see how complicated it is. First of all, of course, how to work the soil and how to grow things, which requires a lot of knowledge of plant dynamics and needs and different features. Then, of course, there's marketing skills, especially social media, how to tell the world about what you're doing and how to make sure that you can reach out for potential future customers. There's things like carpentry, plumbing, refrigeration, irrigation, machinery use, and repair, because you don't always have an opportunity to call a mechanic out to your farm 20 miles out of town. How to manage people, how to do payroll. And then what you've described, Louise, the subtle but important nuances about body mechanics and ergonomics that make farming over time for people who are working both physically as well as mentally, to be able to continue doing it year after year without, not just burning out from the stress of knowing whether your markets will be there, but also from the physical challenges of repetitive action and doing something many, many times over. So it's actually quite a complicated business to operate a farm and to have all these skills in your head and easily accessible. Would that be a fair assessment, Herman?
Yeah.
Louise?
There's definitely a variety of different skills and knowledge that you need to have to kind of for the overall running of a vegetable farm. And I can't remember what I was going to say next.
Well, we're pretty close to the end of the program anyway. And you both of you have done a tremendous job of outlining the experience of running a farm. I want to let listeners know that, because we talked about it as well, that there is a bill that came out in 2016, which is a little bit changing the landscape, because the Minister of Agriculture right now was an organic farmer for many years. It's called the British Columbia Local Food Act of 2016. And there are signs of change. They're not all there yet, but you're on the ascendancy rather than on the decline. So we're going to have to end the show now, but I want to again thank both of you for the last show and for this show, showing what farmers really do and what we need to do to make farming a core part of our society in the future. Thank you very much, Herman and Louise Bruins.
Thank you.
Thank you for your interest.